All right, folks. Get enough to eat? Okay, back you go later. Apparently, they gave us more food than we ordered. They had a problem in cutting the sections, but we got charged the same amount actually with a discount, so that was all good news. How many of you came to one of the focus groups? Can I see a show of hands? Lots and lots of you. Wonderful. All right, so those of you who have came to a group met Dr. Hoyt ahead of time. I think you've sensed his spirit, a man who truly loves God, and I think is very well qualified to help this church take its next steps forward. This is off the GHC, Growing Healthy Churches, website, so this is the propaganda they put out about him. This nationally known pastoral coach, congregational consultant, and former judicatory executive leads GHC congregations through effective assessments. Bill is a master in aiding congregations in moving from their current levels of ministry to higher and more effective ones that produce disciples. Anybody know what a disciple is? During his 35 years of ministry, Dr. Hoyt has served as pastor, 3 congregations, seminary professor, executive minister of Southwest Baptist Conference. Is that Baptist General Conference? So that's the Swedes. And Swedes, yes. It's the Veds. Consultant to churches, denominations, and other not-for-profit organizations. 3 pastorates were in Big Spring, South Dakota, Spring Lake Park in Minnesota, and Escondido, California. 28 years, Dr. Hoyt has taught classes in preaching, worship, and leadership in both Minnesota and San Diego campuses of the Bethel Theological Seminary. By virtue of his varied background, Dr. Hoyt has been privileged to observe countless, that's a bit of a stretch. Lots of churches from many different vantage points, and I would say many different denominations. Not just American Baptists, but all kinds of denominations and all across the United States, and large churches, small churches, and everybody in the middle. We are, you said 490?
490.
We are number 490 of the assessments that Dr. Hoyt has done in local churches. Okay? I think he's done a few. Dr. Hoyt is president of Next Step Coaching and Consulting. Next Step is an organization committed to enhancing the ministry effectiveness of Christian leaders and organizations through executive coaching and consulting for organizational development. Getting better. That's what it's all about. And if you have not yet read his book, Effectiveness by the Numbers, I highly recommend you get it. Effectiveness by the Numbers. It shows his heart, his love for Christ, his love for outreach, saving the lost. And some really solid numbers about what should the church be measuring. What are the key measurements we should be making? And the one chapter is about the most important measurement. I'll let Dr. Hoyt share that at some point. That if you can't measure anything else, what one thing should you measure? Anyway, it's all in the book. It's a great read, and I highly recommend it to everyone. Let's pray. Gracious Father, I give you great thanks. And praise for being the Lord of the universe and the Lord of this church. And our desire is that we become more effective tool in your hands to fulfill the Great Commission. Dr. Hoyt and his team have come, and already having heard us through surveys and then hearing us again in focus groups, and they bring great amount of wisdom and experience to the table. And we are here to listen, and we're here to absorb. And Father, maybe not everything we hear we can immediately say, oh, that's wonderful, that's great. But Father, we need to hear everything. And that's good. For we are your servants in this matter. We serve you, and this church serves you. We do it in the name of Christ and for the glory of you and your kingdom. Amen. Dr. Hoyt, give him a hand.
Thank you, Pastor. Well, I do appreciate the applause. I need to tell you, though, that I'm not impressed with applause before I start, but if you applaud at the end, you know, well, that might be a good thing, you know, so. I'm embarrassed and humbled by the introduction, I am truly counted a privilege to be asked by your pastor and your leaders, your board of the church to come alongside your church and seek to be a help to you. And I hope you understand appreciation that you should have for your pastor for actually allowing this to happen. Over the years, I have seen churches and pastors that would have benefited tremendously from an assessment, but the pastor is a little bit afraid. You know, it's a little risky. When you ask everybody in the church, what do you think about everything, including the pastor? You know, that's risky. And there are a lot of pastors out there that won't take that risk. They're more concerned about themselves, preserving themselves and all that, than they really are about getting help for themselves and for their church to be as effective as they can in accomplishing the Great Commission. And so I have great respect for any pastor, and I have great respect for your pastor for giving the green light and the encouragement and sitting down with the rest of you and saying, we want to hear this and we want to move forward. Just a word or two about what we'll be doing here. One other thing I'll say is that while there is a small expense to the church, which is basically for the actual expenses of myself and my team, my time is gifted to you from Growing Healthy Churches. Just give you a little idea, if you were contacting me through Next Step and asking me to come in and do this process that we've done with you this weekend, you would be paying somewhere between $6,000 and $8,000 just for my time. And so this is a substantive gift. Now, I want you to know, Growing Healthy Churches doesn't pay me that. You know, we have another arrangement, but it is a significant investment on their part because they care about the churches that, you know, say, we think we can benefit from this, and, you know, we would like you to come in and do it. And so this is a gift. A third of my team could not stay this morning, had other commitments, but Richard Brock, who many of you have known, those of you who have been around for a while, Richard Brock was part of the team, was here doing focus groups with us and helped write the report, and then he left this morning for the other commitments that he had. Terry Clark, Terry, would you stay in the back? Terry is a layperson from our sister church up in Sonora. He's done quite a good number of these with me over about a five-year period of time now. You want to especially thank him. He volunteers his time. Again, the region picks up the tab for his travel and mileage and those kinds of things. So that's part of the gift from the region to you. In the report, we're going to have two sections to it, and I'll say this. We don't take a break, because I learned a long time ago, if I give you a break, you all know. If it's a 15-minute break, it's 30 minutes before you're back. If I tell you it's a 10-minute break, it's 35 minutes before you're back, you know. So we'll only take a break if I need one. And that does happen once in a while, but not very often. And if that happens, the break will last as long as I need the break to last, and I'll be back in talking again. So that's kind of how this thing works. Now, the other thing is, if you need a break in the middle of this, just go do it. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to be offended if you get up and throw something, I'm going to be offended. But, you know, if you get up and if you got bad back and you got to stand up and walk, that doesn't bother me at all. Just do what you have to do to, be comfortable enough to be able to listen. Now, you will have questions. Trust me, you will have questions. And I learned a long time ago that I need to have you reserve the questions till the end. And so I will give the entire report, and then at the end we'll have Q&A. Now, if you have a good memory, if you have a memory like mine, I have a really good memory, it's just short. So if you have a memory like mine, you know, get something you can write on and something you can write without, and jot your question down so that at the end you'll be able to remember the question that you wanted to ask, because there will be time for Q&A at the end. The report comes in two sections, basically. We start out with affirmations, and we do that not to just be nice to you and say a few nice things before we whack you alongside the head. That's not what the affirmations are about. The reality is that we believe from Scripture and from experience and working with many, many churches over the years that God builds on strengths in churches. You know, as individual Christians, God does not call us to do things that he doesn't equip us to do. And he's either already given us the gifting and the ability to do what he expects us to do, or he will bring us into context where we can get what we need in order to be equipped to do what he wants us to do. I think the same thing is true for churches. And the strengths that God builds into a church are the strengths that he knows that church needs in order for that church to do what he wants it to do in the community. And so for every church to understand fully the strengths that it has, because these are the building blocks that God has put into place for you to be utilized to, in fact, accomplish his will. Now, obviously, in the assessment process, we pick up on things that are not strengths, and weaknesses, and issues that need to be dealt with. We're not going to list them all. Breathe a big sigh of relief, because in any church, that would have us here till about 10 tonight. But we're not concerned. Every church has weaknesses. Every church has areas where they don't do very well. There's no church that does it all exceedingly well. But out of the things that we see that would cause us some concern, significant findings, we call them, out of those significant findings, what we are going to talk with you about are the ones that we believe are getting in the way of your building on the strengths that God has given you in order to maximize your effectiveness for the kingdom and for him. And so we do the affirmations, and then we move to significant findings and prescriptions. We call them prescriptions, not recommendations, because, this is medicine you need to take. Now, I don't know how it works for you. Pastor mentioned a little bit this morning the analogy of the doctor. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I've been going to the same doctor for about 22 years now. And truth of the matter is, I need a new doctor. The problem is that every year when I go to get my physical, he checks me all out, gives me all the tests, and every single year he says to me, you have to eat less and exercise more. And you can see how well that's working. So I need a new doctor, right? Not really. What I need is to follow his prescription. And so these are not suggestions, they are not recommendations, they are prescriptions. And in a sense, Terry and Richard and I are the church doctors. We've been in town, we've taken your temperature, run all the tests, we've got the numbers, and now we're telling you, here are the pills that you need to take in order to come to the level of health that God has in mind for you. So let's start with those affirmations, and sitting in this beautiful place, probably fitting that we start out with the renovations that you've done. I didn't see it. It's actually been quite a number of years since I was in your sanctuary, but I kind of have a feeling that probably not much had changed between when I was here and when you started the renovations. So I have something of a picture of what it used to look like. But all I can say is what you've done in the foyer area and in the restrooms and the parlor and here, as well as some of the other things that you have done and addressed, this is just incredibly good. And it's not just to make it nicer for you to be here, but the reality is what you had was not attractive to somebody who wasn't used to it. And, it's kind of like our home. You don't want to be around, if you're selling your home, you don't want to be around when the couple comes through that's thinking about buying it. Because they see all the stuff that, and you haven't even noticed that because you live there. And the quality of what you've done. And, I look around and I don't see any Baptist buff on the walls. Man, that's cool. It's really good. Whoever has guided you in this, man, they got taste. They know how to make the place look good. And so that's to be affirmed, because it makes this a much more effective tool for you to use to reach unchurched people. Second affirmation would be staff. You know, you say, well, you got to do this all the time, right? And the answer is no. And sometimes we don't affirm staff because we know that's not appropriate. And if we did, the people go, what were they smoking when they wrote that part of the report? You know, I mean, it's like, mm-mm. But here, you know, you have a pastor and a pastoral couple who's been with you for a good long time. They've been faithful. They've been caring in the ministry that they have had. And they have provided a leadership to you. God has used them in many of your lives and in the life of this church. And there are numerous ways in which you spoke of that, numerous ways in which we observed that as we looked at both the data and looked at and listened to you as people in the focus groups. Pastor Jenny, again, a great deal of appreciation that you have for her, and rightly so. And we want to affirm Pastor Jenny. She's a strength for you to work with. The preaching, both Pastor Rich and Pastor Jenny. Now, I do understand that there's a handful of people around that, you know, you like one better than the other. You know, well, that's true in any church where there are different, and that's okay. What's not okay is for the, you know, handful of you who, if one's preaching, you don't come. You just come when the other one's preaching. Hey, it's time to grow up, folks. It's time to grow up. You have two people here who are able to take the Word of God and lay it out for you. And if you're listening and paying attention and allowing the Spirit of God to speak, there's something you can take away and learn about and grow from. You have good preaching here. You're telling us that. And while we'll have a conversation about a couple adjustments to make, sitting this morning and listening to your pastor preach, he preached the Word of God. He taught the Bible to you. Dave, not part of the family, but part of the family. I don't know how many churches have an important part of the church like Dave that commutes an hour to get here and an hour to go home at night. But be thankful he does, and many of you are thankful that he does. And then Sharon, and Sharon is listed last, not because, you know, she was an afterthought of the last one, but because it allows us to segue into the next affirmation that we want to make, and that is, as we begin to look at ministries, first of all, we do want to affirm music and worship. Having taught worship, I have a primary concern that it's a service where God is honored, God is praised, where we are led into the presence of God and given an opportunity to both listen to God and to speak our praise and appreciation to Him. And at significant points this morning as I sat in worship, I experienced that. And I need to tell you, I'm a hard audience. Because first of all, some of you have already figured this out, I'm highly analytical. I am always trying to figure stuff out. I go to a good restaurant with my wife, and I'm trying to figure out everything that's in the meal, and she gets so put up with me, she just looks at me and says, would you just shut up and enjoy the meal, you know, kind of thing. That's how I am. That's how I'm wired. I cannot not analyze things. And then, you know, when you spend 23 years teaching preaching and studying preaching and all of that, you know, for me to get out of the analyzing mode and to have my spirit and my heart brought into the presence of God where there's a connection and God has the opportunity to actually break through my analytical mode and to communicate. And that happened this morning. Now, I in a little bit, actually, I'm going to save that and I'll talk about that when we get to that point later. But the music and worship, we want to affirm the life groups. You are definitely, from our perspective, on the right track with them. You have at present time probably about 70 or so, at least in your last round that were involved, and we're hoping for more in this coming round this fall. And the fact that you are doing a combination of groups that are short in duration and yet allowing groups that want to meet longer to do, all of those are the right things to do. And it's incredibly important because I do not know a healthy, growing church that sustains its health and growth without a vital, vibrant, growing small group ministry. And so it's important that we can affirm you on what you have as you build toward even more in that regard. Children's ministry, very clearly a strength of the church and a very important strength, because you cannot reach young families if you do not have a high-quality children's ministry. And if you do not reach young families, the church has a very limited future. Men's ministry. You know, I wish that we could affirm men's ministry more often. The reality is it's very rare that we can affirm men's ministry. But, you know, in the section of the survey where we asked you to tell us how, you know, God's blessed you and how you've benefited from being part of the church, numerous men talking about the men's ministry, a few wives talking about the men's ministry because they see some changes in their husbands that they like, you know, some of that stuff going on. And then in some of the focus groups, just hearing you talk and where you see God at work, and we concur with you that God is very much at work in your men's ministry. And again, it should never be men at the expense of women being involved in ministry and in leadership in a church, but I do not know a healthy church that does not have men who step up and provide leadership both in the home and in the church. And so a strong men's ministry is incredibly important, and we want to affirm you in continuing to build that ministry so that you can reach more and more men and help them learn what it means to walk with Christ and to be a leader in their home, in community, and in the church. The youth ministry, the fact we've got some young people sitting over here, that doesn't happen very often. Usually I'm speaking to a bunch of the old guys and gals, you know, bald hair, blue, you know, bald-headed, blue-haired, you know. Terry did the focus group with the youth, came back just energized by interacting with your young people. And learning from them their perceptions of the church and what's happening in the church and in their lives as a result of the church. We want to affirm the youth ministry team because that's the key to why you have young people sitting here and why it is that good things are happening in their lives. Out of that focus group, learned that the teens, at least those who attended, feel very much included and cared about by the people of the church, not just their mentors, but especially their mentors. And the affirmation for those of you who are mentoring. Now, we're keenly aware of the fact that there are some of you, including some of you as mentors, who think that what we really need around here is a youth pastor. And I want to tell you that the strategy that you are currently using for youth ministry is the only strategy that I see working in churches other than the mega churches, who can identify and afford to find someone and get someone with youth ministry experience over a period of time, proven track record, who come in and stay with the youth for a long period of time. With that exception of the very large churches that can find and afford those people, the only effective strategy that I see for giving consistent support, encouragement, and teaching to teenagers is lay-led youth ministries where the people of the church who aren't going anywhere tomorrow, who are here and committed to the church and going to be around and stay the whole time that the teenagers are growing up in the church. Those are the youth ministries that work, because here's the deal. Youth ministry is not about speaking words to them and having them write words in notebooks. Youth ministry is about relationships. When I think back to the youth sponsors in the church that my wife and I grew up in, I cannot remember a single lesson that they taught. I can't even remember a single point of a single lesson that they taught. But I learned how to love Jesus because they love Jesus and they taught us how to love Jesus. And out of the 17 years that they were, in those days, youth sponsors, you know, we weren't cool and call them mentors and, you know, the youth sponsors, you know. And out of the 17 years that they were the youth sponsors, there were 25 of us who were in full-time ministry. Because the other thing they taught us was, there is nothing greater in life than serving Jesus. And if you can't serve Jesus, you ought to first try and see if God's calling you to full-time service. And if he doesn't call you to full-time service, the message they delivered to us was, then you be the most involved and the best layperson in a church that you can possibly be, because there's nothing better than serving Jesus. Now, I don't remember the lesson that that was taught in. I'm not sure those words in a study form ever came out of their mouths. But we knew. We were taught. And I'm a product of a lay-led youth ministry. And as I work with churches, the churches that have consistent, over a significant period of time, effectiveness in raising up teenagers to really be disciples and follow after Jesus, they are all, with the exception of the mega churches, they are all lay-led. Another affirmation would be caring for the care for one another here. Prayer chain, prayer quilts, there's a whole bunch of other illustrations, but it's really, really clear. Again, go through that section, and as we read through that section of how's the church blessed you, I mean, over and over and over again, you give stories, testimonials to how this church and the people of this church have ministered to you in times of need, in times of crisis, or to family members, or to neighbors that you know. I want to also affirm the core of deeply committed lay people that are here. Every church has people that basically take up upholstery on Sunday morning, and that's pretty much all they do. You have some of them, but it's impressive the number of people that you have who are deeply committed to Jesus Christ and deeply committed to this church. This is going to be a little hard to read, perhaps, but one of the things that we asked for in a self-study is how many adults 21 years of age and older. Now, this number is actually higher when you bring teenagers into the picture, but the way we frame it is how many adults 21 years of age and older regularly attending do you have in the church? And you have 159, as it was reported to us. And then the next question is, out of the number of adults 21 years of age and older who are currently serving, so how many of this 159 are serving? And that's 88. Now, every church has people in it that believes that 10% of the people are doing 90% of the work. Every church has those people. They're never right. It's always more people doing the work. But it's usually not this high. 55, you're at 55.3%. And that is actually fairly good. It's not where you want to be. In a really healthy church, that number will be somewhere between 66 and 75%. So somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of the people who could be serving at any given time are serving in some capacity or another. Now, the other number is that you have a total number of adults 21 years of age and older who are currently serving in more than one significant ministry role or leadership. You have 39 out of the 88, which is 44.3%, and that's higher than you want for health. Your target in that should be you don't want any more than 10% of the people who are serving to be serving in more than one significant capacity. Now, the volume of things that you're doing requires that people in this church are going to be involved in more than one thing. For a church your size, the things that you're involved in and the things that you're doing, it demands this. Somebody kind of had the perception it's the same people that are doing the work. Well, that perception is absolutely right, because you're not that big a church. You know, you don't have that many different people that could. But the reality is you do have some people who are sitting here taking up space, breathing the air, and not contributing. to the kingdom and to the life of this church. And so while you're much better off than many, matter of fact, much better off than most churches in this regard, there's room for growth. And there are some of you who need to get busy for Jesus. And then not just the committed people, but particularly those who have stepped up and agreed to provide leadership to various ministries. Again, time and time again, as we listened and talked with different people, we were just incredibly impressed with the commitment that you have and the excitement that your people who are providing lay leadership to ministries have about the ministry that God has entrusted to them. Another affirmation would be the culture of empowerment. Time and time again, we heard that, you know, with Pastor Rich, if you got an idea and you come to him with it, you know, it's pretty much go for it. You know, that he's been here long enough and lived that way with you long enough that you may think that's the norm. It's not the norm. Oftentimes in my consulting and working with churches, I have to teach pastors and churches to create a culture of empowerment. Because over and over and over again, they're saying to people that God is calling and given a passion to for a certain kind of ministry. You know, they're looking at them and saying, no, can't do that, can't do that, can't do that. And you have in your church a culture of empowerment because of the leadership style of your pastor and because of who he is. And it shows in terms of the great variety of things that you are involved in as a church. Most of those, you know, or at least many of those, have grown from the grassroots up. It's somebody has had this idea, somebody's had this passion, and your culture and your pastor has said, go for it, and God is doing some good things, not top down, but bottom up. That's healthy. That's good. That's right, the way it should be. Now, there is a problem related to that that we're going to get to in a little bit, but fundamentally, that is incredibly healthy. I want to affirm the people. Hate to admit it, but sometimes I do an assessment. I cannot wait to get in the car and drive away. And if I never see those people again in my life, I am just cool with it. You know, hate to say it, but that's the truth. You know, well, that's not what's going to happen when I drive away from your campus this afternoon. I, as a team, we just, a number of times when we were debriefing and talking together, we just said, man, we cannot believe the neat people that we are meeting here. And so just as a people, you need to be affirmed. And, you know, here's the deal. We're outsiders. We're coming in. You know, we're not part of you. And people who are outsiders and just coming in and not part of you, they can sense and feel things that you can't. And, you know, when there's all kinds of tension and all kinds of subterfuge and all kinds of this, that, and the next thing going on, and people really don't like each other, they pick up on that in a hurry. And it was really fun to be here this weekend and realize, yeah, you know, once in a while you get in each other's hair over this, that, and the next thing, because that's normal, that's natural. But you really do like each other, and that's a good thing. And many want the church to grow. Sometimes, again, you know, I just sit there and I say, I don't think these people want the church to grow. But so many of you expressed a heart's desire to see this church grow. And many appear to be willing to do whatever it takes if you just knew what it would take. Just point us in a direction, we'll go for it. And that's an incredibly positive attitude. That is a strength that God can use as you need to make some changes, make some adjustments, and move into the future. We want to affirm your outreach. You're doing some outreach locally. You're doing some outreach that is distant in terms of its locale. You have Bethlehem. You know, any time you can get 17,000 people or so to come onto your campus in a five-day period of time, that's something pretty good going on there. You've got Scott Lane Elementary. You've got Trunk or Treat. You've got Worship in the Park. You know, and these are things that are outreach in nature. You know, you're either doing them predominantly for the other people, or you're doing them predominantly for other people and doing it where they live, not where you live. You know, worship in the park is a great example of that. I mean, they could all come on Sunday morning and worship. You know, you have worship here every Sunday morning, don't you? Yeah, they could come, couldn't they? You know, but at least once a year, just once a year, but at least once a year, you're taking worship to them, intercepting them at the intersections of where they live their lives, rather than making them come to you. That's something you're doing for somebody else and taking it to where they live. Then you have your distant outreach, the Ensenada, the multiple things that you're involved in Ensenada, Operation Blessing, Hands of Mercy, the numerous things that ABW is doing, Seafarers and other things. They went down through the list so fast, we even with three of us writing, we couldn't get them down. Clothing to the homeless in San Francisco, cut and paste, 30-hour famine, Operation Christmas Child, you know, all of these things are outreach kinds of things. You're doing these things for people other than yourself. We want to affirm you for the outreach that you have and the things that you're already involved in the outreach. Now, we're going to talk a little bit more in terms of significant findings and prescriptions about this, but again, what you have here is an incredible strength on which to build. So the bottom line of the affirmations that we want to leave with you is this, that the building blocks of health and growth are here. Sometimes when we do an assessment and I just look and I say, oh my goodness, we have to start from square one. There is not anything this church is doing that is working these days. None of their strategies are the strategies that are working today. So whether it's your life groups where you're using strategies that work today, they will work here if you stick with them and if you promote them and if you and continue to raise up leaders for your small groups and all, it will work. And down through, you got people that want the church to grow. You got people that are willing to do whatever it takes, as long as they know what to do and have a sense that it would in fact help the church. I mean, the building blocks for growth and health are here. And I have this sense that God is just standing on the sidelines, just waiting to say, I want to bless this, and I want to bless this, and I want to bless this, and I want to bless that. Well, we move to significant findings and prescriptions. As Paul Harvey, you're too young to know who Paul Harvey is. Some of you know Paul Harvey. We're going to go to the rest of the story and take a look at some of the things that need our attention and need to be addressed. Attendance. We're going to start out with just some general ones and then zero in on some that are incredibly strategic for you. Attendance. Attendance has been in decline. We asked for a 10-year period from 2001 to 2011. As you can see, we had a steep decline between 2001 and 2003. It's not been steep, but it's been overall, you had a bit of an increase up through 2006. Now, since 2006, you've been declining. Last year and this year, the decline is showing some signs of becoming even a bit more steep than it has been in recent years. Now, I want you to understand that this is a 10-year projection, but the reality is this church has been in decline almost from the time you moved into this building. Chew on that one for a while. But the reality is it is getting to the place now where you can't just ignore it. It does need to be addressed. Another significant finding is that you have an ineffective assimilation system. There's a number of reasons why we know that's true. One is you yourself report, yeah, we have visitors, they come, but they don't come back. Well, if you have an effective assimilation system, you know, they come back. Now, we all understand that there are some people, they come once, they don't tell you who they are, You have no way of knowing how to follow up with them, how to contact them, how to, you know, do anything other than the fact that you happened to be here and had the lights on when they showed up. And they don't come back. And you know, there's not much you can do about that, because they didn't give you a chance to help them connect. You know, there's just not much you can do about that. But the reality is, you, like every other church, you have some people, and they come for a little bit. What happens with people is, you know, they don't sign a registration card. Incidentally, every single one of you needs to sign a registration card every single week. Because if you don't, the visitor in your row won't. So I don't care if you think you're wasting paper. If you think you're wasting paper and that's the issue, you let me know how much you're paying for registration cards. I'll make a gift to the church to cover your registration cards so that all of you, every single week, you sign. Because we want the visitor to sign, because we can't follow up on them if we don't know who they are. And visitors these days, most of them don't give themselves up the first time they're here. They want to go incognito. They're not signing. Even if you sign it, they're not going to sign one. But there will come a day where if you're signing one, they pull it out, they sign it, they fill it out, and you can begin to follow up on them. You have people that come for 3, 4, 5 times, maybe even for 2, 3, 4 months, and then they don't come anymore. One of the questions we asked, do you do exit interviews with them? Do you know why they're leaving? The answer is no, you don't. Well, in an effective assimilation system, you follow up on the people who attend for a while, that you know who they are. If they stop attending, you know, you ask them why. Now, see, most churches worry about, you know, well, we should talk to the people who've been part of our church for a long time and then left. We should find out why they left. Well, maybe you should. But the important ones to know are new people. Unchurched people who for some reason or another have decided maybe they need to go check God out. And you happen to be the nearest church to where they live, and so they stop in. Because if they don't come back, you'll never be able to be used of God to help them come to faith. Those are the ones you ought to be worrying the most about. I'm not saying you shouldn't worry about people long-standing who leave, why they leave. A lot of times they just leave because they don't agree with what the church is doing now. And if that's the case, they need to go to a church where they do agree with what the church is doing now. And they're still going to go to heaven, whether they go to your church or another church. But that person who visits and doesn't know Christ, if they get discouraged because they didn't find what they were looking for here and they don't try another church, they're not going to heaven. And knowing why they don't stay. So an effective assimilation system does its very best in every instance where they possibly can to know why someone attended for a while and then stopped attending. For all of the outward focus that you have in this church, and for all of you who are so outward focused, there are some people around that are pretty me-focused. I don't like... And you fill in the blank. I don't like choruses. We sing them over and over again. Take your hymn book out. Look at some of the hymns. They have what? Choruses. How many of these hymns that you and I'm old, see, so I can talk to. I grew up on hymns. I love hymns. How many of those hymns that we grew up on had choruses? We sang over and over. Every verse, we sing the chorus. Every verse, we sing the chorus. Hey, repetition's been around for a long time. It's not new. Repetition's been around for a long time. It's just we're not repeating what I remember, what I like, what I... See, the thought that there would be people in the church who wouldn't come when one person is preaching and does come when the other one is preaching... I mean, how me-centered and me-focused is that? Grow up. So there are some of you that really need to do an attitude check. You need to get your values right. You need to get your perspectives right. We sang this morning, it's not about me. In worship, it's not about me. Worship is for Him. The only question that matters, the only answer to the question and answer that matters when we walk out of a church on Sunday morning is, did God appreciate worship this morning? And I can tell you right now that if I'm sitting there, now, you know, I'm old, and the church that my wife and I attend, we got a very young music and worship pastor. And, you know, sometimes the music, it ain't my style. I can tell you that. And I have a pretty broad spectrum of music that I appreciate and enjoy. I mean, you'll find reggae and all kinds of things on my iPod. But, you know, it's not my kind of music. But you know what? Doesn't matter whether it's my kind of music. But I can tell you this. If I'm sitting there grumping about the music that morning, I'm not worshiping. And God is not pleased with my worship. So whether you're grumping because it's new and it's not familiar, or whether you're grumping because it isn't as edgy as you would like it to be, it doesn't matter. If you're sitting there grumping about it, trust me, God is not pleased with your worship. And the only thing that matters when you walk out of here is God pleased with the worship that you offered to Him, not were you pleased with the show on the platform. Another significant finding would be that you're not reaching your community. From 1980 to 2012, Santa Clara grew by 33%, grew by a third. During that same period of time, from 1980 to 2012, First Baptist has decreased by approximately 57%. There's no way that you can interpret that in any other way than you're not reaching your community. The growth of your community is outstripping the growth of your church. You're not even staying even. And then we have the age demographics. The blue is the church, and the red or the orange or whatever that color is the community. And look at here, a little over 15% of the church is 0 to 19 years. Your community, it's about 32%. In the 20 to 34 range, the church, that's about 12-13%. And in the community, it's about 21%. We begin to get a little tight in here. It's pretty good. And then all of a sudden, on the other side, it explodes. 55 to 64 in the community is 10%. We have twice that many on a percentage basis in the church here. And you go on through. And, you know, when you look at this, it just makes it really clear. You're not effective in reaching your community because your church is significantly older than the community is. So there are significant parts of the community and people in the community, constituencies within the community, you're not reaching. And then ethnicity. This gets a little embarrassing. You know, 40% of the community is Anglo, 80% of the church is. About 33, 34, 35% the community is Asian. And about 5, 6% of the church is Asian. Folks, you're not reaching your community. Another significant finding, and it's related to you're not reaching your community, is that the community and the culture has changed, and in significant ways, the church has not over the years. Now, I'm not just talking about the ethnic change. That one's obvious. That one's the easy one. But the reality is the culture has changed as well. The white culture in your neighborhood today is not the same white culture of the 1950s. In the 1950s, on Sunday morning, there was a basic expectation, well, good people go to church, at least some of the time. And, you know, you build the building and you open the doors, and if what happens on the platform is halfway decent, the people come. If you haven't noticed, that day is over. I love old Yogi Berra's line. Yogi Berra said one time, if people don't want to come to the ballpark, How are you going to stop them? And that's the culture we live in, folks. People don't want to come to church. How are we going to stop them? Well, you know, if we keep doing what got us to church and expect it to work today, it isn't going to work. We have to make changes. What worked in the 50s is not working anywhere or with any constituency in North America. Isn't that cool? Yeah. I love old cars. My long-suffering wife has been dragged through more car museums than any woman should ever have to endure. And bless her heart, to her credit, she has gotten to be quite an aficionado of old cars. And there came a time not long ago where, you know, I said to her, you know, I'd really like to get an old car. And there was enough of her, you know, that kind of liked old cars and thought that was cool. And she said, well, you know, okay, if you want to. And one of my all-time favorites, 57 Chevy, you know, really cool. Some ways maybe the prettiest car ever put on the road. Let's go do it. I saw one advertised. Yeah?
You
did it go off? Oh, I'm mumbling. Oh, I'm sorry. I will speak up. I like 1957 Chevys. I saw one advertised. Oh, cool. You know, it was pricey, but, you know, I could convince Jesus that I should have this car. So, you know. And so I went to look at it. Oh, it was cherry. Drove it. Oh, man. There's no power steering on this thing. Oh, where's the air conditioning? Oh, that's right. I didn't have air conditioning. Let's see. Where do I plug my iPod in? Yeah, right, y'all. You know what I decided? Pictures of 57 Chevys will do just fine. You know what? As much as I love a 1957 Chevy, I don't want to drive one anymore. You know? That big old bench seat was hard. I'm used to my nice cushy bucket seat, man. That, you know, and that's the way it is with the church. As beautiful as it once was, and as nostalgic as we may be about it, it is not what people want to drive and ride in today. As we begin to burrow down now on some things, I want to, first of all, talk about mean scores. Now, mean scores are not the opposite of nice scores, okay? let me just tell you how we get to them. You remember how on the survey they had so many of these things that said do not agree, somewhat agree, all the way over to strongly agree. To calculate mean scores based on the responses that you gave us, it goes this way. If you check do not know, that doesn't count. In other words, if you genuinely did not know enough about an area of ministry to have an opinion and to register it, that area of ministry doesn't suffer because you didn't know enough about it to be able to answer. So do not know answers are not factored in. Do not agree responses are given a value of 1. Somewhat agree responses are given a value of 2. Agree responses are given a value of 3. Significantly agree responses get a value of 4. And strongly agree responses get a value of 5. Now, what this functionally means is that on a specific statement, if every single person who took the survey responded, do not agree to that statement would have a mean score of 1.0. By the same token, if there were a statement on the survey and absolutely everybody who took the survey strongly agreed with that statement would have a mean score of 5.0. In other words, the range for mean scores is 1.0 to 5.0. Okay? Now, let's talk about the ranges and what they mean. Anything that has a mean score on a 5-point Likert scale like we use on the survey, anything that has a 4.2 or above score, we say has sizzle. Now, I want you to know that sizzle is a highly technical term that I learned from the people at Gallup. Now, in-house at Gallup, they actually use this term. Now, they don't use it publicly because you wouldn't take them seriously if they did. But in-house, on a 5-point Likert scale, if they see anything that gets a 4.2 or above, they say, oh, this has got sizzle. Now, what do they mean by that? What they mean by that is you can't shut up about it. It means every chance you get, you're talking to somebody about it. You know, if you think the preaching and you thought the sermon Sunday was really great and you're at the water cooler at work on Tuesday and you hear somebody, you know, oh man, you should have heard our pastor on Sunday. You can't shut up about it. It's got sizzle. Anything that comes in at the 4-point or 4.1 range, excellent. Anything from 3.7, 3.8, 3.9, good, solid. Anything at 3.4, 5, or 6, it's okay. It's okay, but it's just okay, you know. Then 3.0, 3.1, 2, and 3 clearly needs work. And then from 2.6 to 2.9, cause for concern. And anything 2.5 and below, it's triage. You know, it's, man, you know, get the blue light going, you know, clear the emergency room, get them in, let's figure out if we can save the life of this thing, you know, kind of a deal. So that's kind of the range. All right, now let's see what we can learn about your church from the mean scores. And now we don't make these numbers up. You made them up by taking the survey and by responding as you did.
Quick question. Did you do anything about standard deviations to give the range?
We have standard deviation in all of them, and all of them fall within the range of standard deviation. We do have all of those calculations, and we do look at them. Before I talk about all of the categories, I've done the explanation of mean scores because I want to show you another significant finding, and I want to show it how we come to that conclusion out of mean scores. So the significant finding is this, that there is a lack of a passionate spirituality in this church. How do we come to that conclusion? Well, on these statements, there's a whole section where we ask about this, and you responded. And over the past 2 years, I've grown a lot spiritually. Your mean score on that is 3.2. In a healthy church where people are feeling like, man, I'm excited about my faith. I cannot believe where I am this year compared to where I was last year. You know, that number is going to be in the range of 3.75, 3.8, 3.85, or above. So your best score in this category is not a good score. Over the past 2 years, I've grown substantially in my understanding of the Bible, 3.1. Hey, there's one of two things going on here, folks. Either you are already Bible wizards, or you all have some work to do. See, I don't care how long you've been in the Word. God's Word is always deeper. God's Word is always richer. There's always more that can be learned from Scripture. And people who are passionate about their faith have a passion to be learning the Word and growing as a result of studying the Word. Over the past 2 years, I've made significant changes in how I live my life. Well, man, you all must be pretty perfect. You have 2.9%, and, you know, there's not much apparently that needs work and needs change in your life. You got it nailed, do you? I'm quite regular in reading my Bible, 2.7. I mean, this is sackcloth and ashes time, folks. Then there's an evangelistic ineffectiveness. Again, you know this. We're not telling you anything right now you don't know. You made it really clear. Our church's website. Boy, when your website is the strongest score you have in terms of the things that help you do evangelism, you know, there's work to be done. And so our youth ministries are effective in reaching youth in our community, 3.0. I pray regularly for specific non-believers to become Christians, 2.8. What's the matter? Is that a budget issue? Don't you have money enough in the budget to be able to pray for unsaved people? I mean, do you have unsaved people around you that are going to hell? Do you care? Do you care enough to pray? Wow. Over the past 2 years, I've become more regular in sharing my faith with unchurched, unbelieving people I know. 2.8, our church is effective in reaching unchurched children from the community. 2.8, our church is effective at evangelism. 2.5, I mean, it's an accurate picture of your church, but that's not the score you want. Men's ministry is effective in reaching unchurched men from the community. 2.2. But man, you've got it going now. You've got a base from which to change that. But right now, you know, you're looking at it yourselves and saying, no, we don't get that job done very well. Women's ministry, 2.0. Another reason that we know that you're ineffective at baptism, ineffective at evangelism is your baptism rate. The blue line represents your baptisms over the last 11 years, 2001 to 2011. And you can see you've had some years it was fairly decent, 13 in 2002, looks like 12 in 2006, 12 again in 2009. You've had some pretty bad years in between. Now, what the red bars are about is this. The minimum, catch this, this is the minimum. This is the floor, not the ceiling. You ain't nowhere till you're here. The minimum growth through conversions marked by baptisms in a healthy church will be 10% of your average weekly worship attendance. So what the red line shows is your average weekly worship attendance for those years. And you can see that in all of that period of time, you neither met nor exceeded those marks. There's room for improvement. Now, the good news is you're baptizing some people. That's good. I'm going to some church where the line's pretty flat and it's down around two or three. You know, it's not like there's nothing happening here, but you're nowhere near what we see in healthy churches that actually have a passion for reaching lost people. Now, the other thing that affects this is that my hunch is that this is all baptisms, including children of the church. The 10% is adult conversion baptisms. It's not that the children of the church don't count when you baptize them, but for this purpose, they don't count. Now, when we use the word adult, if a teenager from an unchurched home comes into the life of the youth group, into the life of the church, finds Christ, even though technically they're not an adult, they're an adult as far as this is concerned. So, generally speaking, 13 and above, but 13 and above, if they're not having grown up in the church, and now at 13, 14, 15, being baptized. See, if you're not reaching the children of the church, you have another issue to deal with. It's very different from this issue, and that's why you don't count the same way. So there's room for growth here. You're not nearly as effective at evangelism as you could be and should be. Now let's go back to those mean scores in the categories 4.2, 4.1, excellent, good, solid, just okay, clearly needs work, cause for concern, and triage. In the survey, there's actually 15 categories that we look at, and let's see how you did in those areas of the life of the church. Well, you had no categories in the sizzle range, and you had no categories in the excellent range. Now, I want to say one thing to you. In communities like yours, where you have a high number of professionals working in very high pressure kinds of situations, what you wind up is having people who have extremely high expectations. And sometimes on this kind of an exercise, people who have extremely high expectations will rank things lower than they really are. I do an awful lot of work with churches in the D.C. area. You would not believe the similarities between the peninsula and the area around Washington, D.C. the culture is amazingly similar. And I run into the same thing there. So you do have a factor here of who you are, where you are, how you're hardwired. You're a little harder on yourselves than you'd ought to be. But even taking that into consideration, the fact that you have nothing that you rate in the sizzle range and nothing that you rate in the excellent range, that's something we need to take a look at and begin to address. Now, you have three categories in the good, solid range. They are preaching, children's ministry, and facilities. And then you have six categories in the okay range. Involvement in commitment and worship at 3.6. Now, I want to say that I think one of the areas where the number should be higher, given the reality of your church, is worship. And I've seen this dynamic before. One of the reasons that it's 3.6 is we've got some of you who are not really happy with worship because you want it to be edgier. And you've got some other of you who would really dearly like to see worship be more like the 60s and 70s. And so, you know, you don't rate it very high. And so the score gets depressed simply because, not because it's the reality of the quality of the worship that you have, but it's a reflection of your preferences about the worship in the church. Incidentally, one of the problems, you know, you're doing blended service. One of the problems with blended services is it makes nobody happy. It's just the reality. Because there are always people who want it to be more of something on one side or the other of it. Yeah, it's really a difficult thing. That's why some maturity about worship, maturity about is church about me or is it about serving God, is necessary in churches. Because no church will ever have unanimity on preferences. Well, actually, there are some, but they're about dead. Another okay at two of them at 3.5, care, fellowship, and community, and youth ministries. Again, I think the youth ministries is much lower than the reality is, and I think, again, it's because some of your mentors are feeling like, you know, I'm not really qualified to do this. Our kids deserve better. You know, some of you are convinced we need a youth pastor, and since we don't have a youth pastor, you're not going to rate this high until you got a youth pastor. And so, you know, I understand why this one's where it is, but I want to tell you, you rank yourselves low in both the worship area and your youth ministry area, and I think also probably in your children's area as well. I think the reality is the strength and the health of those areas of ministry are significantly higher than you rank them yourselves. Finances at 3.4, communication at 3.4. You had five categories in the clearly needs work area, mission, vision, and purpose. From my perspective, that one's higher than it should be, but some of you are really kind to yourself on that one. Prayer ministry at 3.2, adult ministry at 3.2. You know, again, it's not uncommon for us to see adult ministry come in low when people don't understand that these days the primary method of adult ministry is small groups. And if they're looking for adult ministry in the way in which we used to do it, hardly any church is doing it that way anymore, and so a lot of times adult ministries actually comes in ranking quite low, when in reality there's some very significant adult ministry going on in the church. Leadership at 3.1, evangelism, outreach, and missions at 3.0, and you have one category in the cause for concern, and we've already addressed that one, and I would agree this is cause for concern. This is something you as a congregation, as well as you as individual Christians, need to be on your knees before God and saying, how should we be growing, and what's up with me, and then what's up with us as a church, that we are not growing and becoming increasingly passionate about our faith in Jesus Christ. Now, the good news is you have no categories in the triage range, so a little cheer. Yeah, you can cheer that one. Yeah. I actually did, it wasn't a church, a year and a half ago, I did a denominational. You love the word judicatory? It was a mid-level judicatory. We assessed, it was not the same because it wasn't a church, but we also had 15 categories in there, and 13 out of the 15, they ranked themselves in the triage range. There was a little work to be done there. The good news is God's been at work, and it's a very different place now. Your average mean score for all statements was 3.4. I think if we factor in, based on what I've seen in other communities similar to your, in churches that are in areas where people are in professions and in high-pressure situations like many of you are, that this probably could be adjusted up by 0.2. But even at that, 3.6 is not where you want them. You want this to be around 3.8, 3.85. So there's room to grow in this. It's not a disaster area, but definitely room to grow. It's in the just okay range, and healthy churches will average 3.75 or above as the composite of all statements. So there's work to be done. I mean, that's the message. And to continue doing things as you're doing them, you keep on doing what you're doing, you'll keep on getting what you're getting. And so if we want different results, we have to begin to do some things differently. The next thing we want to talk to you about is the life stage on the life cycle. We oftentimes think and act as though churches will live forever. Churches are birthed and churches die. What do you think is the average lifespan of a church in America today? Call it out. I'm a little hard of hearing, so yell it out. 10 years. Oh, my goodness. Give him a happy pill. He needs help. You pessimistic about everything? No, I'm sorry. You can guess. It's a little more than 10. But what do you think it is? Huh? 100. 75. 20. Okay, well, here's the deal. The Texas Baptist Convention, you say, well, what's with them? They're Southern Baptist, you know, but... The reason I pick them is they've actually studied it. But the other thing that's important to know is that just the Texas State Convention, Southern Baptist, is larger than all but 10 entire denominations in America today. My point being, this is not a small sample of churches. This is a large sample of churches, okay? And they did a study, and they discovered that the average lifespan for a church is about 75 years. Roughly the lifespan of a human being. Now, the deal is this. As human beings, we don't get do-overs. I mean, even Lazarus didn't get to do it over again. All he got to do was pick it up where he left off. You know? We're born, we mature, we reach our peak efficiency, and then, you know, me, about 2 years ago, I left my peak efficiency and, you know, begin to move into your decline, and then, you know, we die. Well, the same thing can happen to organizations, but the good news about organizations is organizations can have do-overs. Organizations can reinstitute a new life cycle. And understanding where a church is at a given moment in time is important. Where it is on the life cycle is important, because where you are on the life cycle helps us know what you need to address in order to establish and begin to build a new life cycle. In other words, write a new chapter in the life of the book, the life of the church. Now, there are 5 stages in the life of a church. The first is the entrepreneurial stage. A church plant is a great example of that. I mean, a church plant, they have no history, they have no tradition, they have no people, they have no programs that they've been doing for 28 years. Everything's new. And they have an entrepreneurial spirit. They will try anything. And they'll try it not for very long, because if it doesn't start producing in a hurry, they bag it and they go to something else. You know? Now, not just new church plants, but, existing churches can have a pretty significant entrepreneurial spirit in them. My wife and I happen to be part of a church like that. Just amazing to watch some of the new initiatives that come along in a church that's been around for 55 years now and is big enough to just settle in on what we've been doing and what we currently do. Very significant entrepreneurial spirit there. And then the second phase is the organizational phase. And what happens here is, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit's beginning to work. Some of the things they're trying, people are starting to come, are working. Some of the people are starting to come. They're coming to find Jesus. They got more and more people coming. And there comes a day and a time where they go, oh, my goodness, we got to stop flying by the seat of our pants. We got to get organized, or this thing's going to come off the wheels are going to come off the wagon here, you know. And so they begin to get their act together. They begin to get organized. They begin to put the systems in place that are necessary to sustain the growth and ministry that that God is blessing in their midst. And then they move into peak efficiency, and this is when people understand the mission and the vision of the church. They're committed to it. They're involved in giving. They're involved in serving. They're excited about what's going on. They're telling everybody in sight about what God's doing in their church, and the ministries are strong, and people are finding Jesus, and people are maturing in the faith, and it's peak efficiency. Everything's happening like you would want it to have happen. And then, just like with human beings, there comes a time where, you know, some stuff begins to set in, and we begin to get institutional, and the institutional stage in a church is when, well, you know, that's a good idea, but we've never done it that way before. We tried that once ago, and it's about 25 years ago. It didn't work, you know, we're not going to try that again. And then people become more important than the mission and ministry effectiveness because, you know, we've been friends for a long time. And, yeah, I know she's not very effective in that area of ministry, and we really need a new leader there. But, you know, if we replace her, she's going to feel bad. And so we'll just hope that one day she gets tired of it, and then, you know, we can put somebody in there. You know, that's institutional. And then we have descent toward death. And I use that label because when a church begins to think and act in this way, they are a lot closer to death than they realize. Here's how I like to illustrate it. Do you realize there are actually idiots in this world who do that? Anybody recognize this? This is the ski jump at Innsbruck. Do you see? Let's see, where is this thing? How come it's not showing up? Did you see it? Okay, where is it? How come I can't see it? Oh, it's down below. Duh. Okay, see this thing, the square thing down there? At the end of the ski jump, see, ski jump goes down, it ends there. You see that? You know what it is? Yeah, it's a cemetery. Exactly. It's a cemetery. Man, if I even had a moment's thought that I would do that, knowing there's a cemetery at the end, I ain't doing this. But now, the point is this. Two things are irrefutably true here. Once this person pushes off, there's no turning back. They can't change their mind. And the second thing that is irrefutably true is the more time passes, the faster they go. That's descent to death. Well, where do we get life cycle scores anyway? Do we make them up? Not really. You remember on the survey, we had five questions, a series of five questions. They were picked two. And we had 10 things there, and you could pick two, and you were supposed to pick two out of the 10. Well, the first of those were all statements that dealt with commitment to mission and vision. And by how you responded to them, we know where you are on the life cycle in regard to mission and vision. The second one has to do with involvement of people. The third one has to do with program, structure, and organization. The fourth one has to do with attitude toward change. And the fifth one, all of the statements have to do with morale, esteem, and confidence. And by the time you pick the two from each of those five, we know where you are on the life cycle. So where are you on the life cycle? Well, here's where you are. You are in the institutional stage. Now, I look at a lot of these. You don't. And so, let me tell you what you're looking at. You are in the institutional stage. But a lot of times, this part of the... Let me see. Where? Help me find this thing again. Higher. There I am. Okay. First of all, let me explain this. These numbers on the side indicate the number of times that one of you picked one of the answers in that area. So, in other words, we have about probably about 90 or so that picked an entrepreneurial response. You had about 150 or so that picked an organizational response. You have about 170, 75 peak efficiency, 250 at institutional, and about 225 responses that are in the descent to death. Now, we see in many, many churches the institutional is much higher. In other words, they are thoroughly institutional. And these are very, very, let me get it again. These are very, very low. So on the left side, very, very low. The reality here is you are institutional. You do have some trending toward descent to death. In other words, you keep on going the way you're going and you're not going to like what happens. You do have some elevation to peak efficiency. That's the good news. And you do have some elevation on the entrepreneurial and organizational side, which means there's some of you that are ready to try whatever. Some of you that are realizing some of what we knew we need to do better. And, you know, you're in the process of doing some of the things, or at least want to do some of the things that will build the church up. So this is not a disastrous life cycle, but it is a very deeply concerning one, because bottom line, it means that you are in the institutional life stage with a growing trend toward descent to death. You have some strength in the peak efficiency life stage. You have some modest elevation in the entrepreneurial and organizational life stages. And so what it means is you are not a church at risk at this moment. Not yet. But you must make decisions and changes now, or you will be very, very soon. Now, the value of the life cycle, it indicates what needs to be done. It helps us know what needs to be addressed for you to establish a new life cycle. Surprise, surprise. Mission and vision. A clear, concise, compelling, unifying, God-big vision. Something you can't do if God doesn't bless you. You currently don't have that. As a matter of fact, it really appears to us as the assessment team like this church has not really had that kind of a vision since you built this building. That the last big, clear, concise, compelling, and unifying vision that you had was the vision to build this building. And that was a long, long time ago. Mission and vision must trump relationships. It doesn't mean you dump on people. It doesn't mean you intentionally hurt people. But it does mean that when people are getting in the way of the church's accomplishing the mission and vision, as a church, you have to pick the mission and the vision over the relationships. And in institutional churches, that is very hard to do because you value the relationships so highly. Now, the good news is I've worked with many churches over the years where they have had to bite that bullet and face that, and they've done it. There's been some pain, there's been some tears, but no lasting damages to people and to relationships. On the other hand, sometimes there is, but mission and vision has to rule. To establish a new life cycle, there are systems that you need to address. Assimilation, we've already talked about that. Leader development and communication. There are some ways in which you are developing ministry leaders in a reasonably good way, but overall your leadership development system needs development, and so does your communication one. Now, the last significant finding before we move to prescriptions is that your outreach is an outstanding strength that you have, which you can build on. But the problem is that you have been investing a tremendous amount of time, money, and people resources in outreach. And that's to be commended. The problem is that you have not been doing outreach in a way that results in either evangelistic impact or results in your church growing. You need to make some changes, some fundamental changes in terms of how you're doing outreach. One of the things is that, and this is a function of, you know, pastor and a culture of empowerment, which says if you've got a good idea, run with it. You know, all of a sudden you've got a whole bunch of good ideas. But the result is that you wind up with the impact of a shotgun rather than a laser. And you can wind up where you're doing a whole bunch of things that are good, but none of them are strategic toward helping the church to grow. And so you need to move from being the shotgun approach to strategically linking every outreach thing you do to the mission and vision. So every outreach that you do has to contribute to the accomplishing of the mission and vision. Otherwise, you don't do it. You do something else. Second, currently, your outreach is all about events and projects. In order to actually build your church and in order to build relationships with people so that you can earn the right to help them come to Jesus and talk to them about spiritual things, your outreach has to be done in a way that creates presence and relationships. You cannot hit and run and actually change lives. You cannot hit and run and actually change communities. On the international mission scene, for 100 years in North America, the model was the People's Church of Canada model, where they were a great missionary church because they supported about 300 different missionaries. Now, what they didn't tell you about that is they gave about $20 a month to 300 missionaries, spread all over the world, and they really had no impact anywhere. Increasingly today, churches are investing themselves in missions not by supporting a whole slew of an array of missionaries hither and yon around the world, but they are picking a field, an area, a people group, and they are supporting maybe multiple missionaries who are there. And they don't have short-term missions that go wherever people want the next international trip to be. But they go back to the same place, back to the same community, and they are constantly doing new things or continuing to do things that they've started in that community so that they create a presence in that community and their actual relationships in that community. I do mission work in Vietnam. There are some incredible examples of churches that have actually picked a province in Vietnam, and they have come back year after year after year after year. Many of them come back multiple times in a year. And they have free rein to present the gospel in a country where technically it's legal to present the gospel, but functionally it is not. And they have complete freedom to do it because the local leaders are so appreciative of what they have done for their community and the fact that they keep coming back and are making a difference in the community. Your outreach, many of the things that you're doing are attractional in nature, and they need to become missional. You know, Bethlehem, as great as it is, they have to come to you to get it. Now, I don't think you can put that show on the road. I mean, you know, that's not the answer. And it is okay. Some outreach, you know, can be very effective and still require them to come. But basically, the most effective outreach is not outreach that you do at your place, at your convenience, but it's where you go to where they are actually living their lives. You're intercepting them at the natural intersections of their lives instead of making them come to the natural intersections of your lives. It's taking Jesus and taking the church and taking Christians to them rather than making them come to you all the time. And you need to move from having it be mere outreach to being outreach that results in evangelistic effectiveness. And let me talk a little bit more about that. I want to talk with you for a moment about the relationship between outreach and evangelism. Outreach is exactly what the word says. Sometimes people think outreach and evangelism are the same thing. I'll go into to assess a church and I'll say, tell me what you're doing in the area of evangelism, and they tell me all these wonderful outreach things they're doing. Outreach and evangelism are not the same thing. Outreach is exactly what the word says. It's reaching out. It's going to the people rather than making them come to you. It's intercepting people at the natural intersections of their lives and doing something that is meaningful to who? Them. That's outreach. Okay. Evangelism, on the other hand, is introducing people to the good news, the gospel, resulting in their accepting Jesus as Savior and Lord. It's not outreach. It's evangelism. Now, while the two are very different things, I believe both biblically and experientially, they are inextricably locked together. Outreach and evangelism go together because outreach without evangelistic results is incomplete. We're nothing more than a Red Cross if all we're doing is good works and outreach. And the Church of Jesus Christ is more than the Red Cross. And evangelism without outreach is largely ineffective. Your pastor this morning was having a little fun about the four laws and some of that. Yeah, there's some people who have come to Christ through the use of the four laws. But I remember one time listening to a speaker at a conference talk about how he used the four laws to lead a man at the urinal next to him to Jesus while they were both finishing their business. And I'm sitting there saying, this is so bogus, I cannot believe it. That guy said yes and prayed a prayer just to get that weird dude next to him gone. Trust me, you know. We earn the right to talk to people about spiritual things by doing good works. We earn their trust so that when we invite them to church, they're more likely to say yes than no by our outreach. Now, there's a biblical basis for this. In Matthew 5:16, in the same way, let your light shine before men so that they may see your wonderful worship, your beautiful sanctuary, your great Bible studies, the wonderful sermons your pastor preaches. No! They see your good works and praise your Father that is in heaven. Acts 2, all the believers were together and had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods they gave to anyone as he had need, and every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts, and they broke bread in their homes, and they ate together, glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Wouldn't it be incredible to be part of a church where every single day on the average somebody was coming to faith in Christ? Wouldn't it be incredible? One day I was reading this passage. Excuse me. Man, if somebody could get me some water, that'd be good. I'd preached this passage. I'd read this passage. I'd taught it in Bible studies who knows how many times. And one day these words leaped off the page at me. Enjoying the favor of all the people. And I thought, wow, that's like the church today, right? Right? No. Man, they mock us, they fear us. What's wrong? Where did this go south? Why did they enjoy the favor of all the people? Well, it's in the text. Of course, I don't know about you, but when I see something in the text that I don't like and I don't want to do, I do one of two things. I either don't read that text again, or I read that part of it, I skip over it really fast. And this text, thank you, this text has that piece in it about selling possessions and goods. We don't like that. Ooh, in America, that, you know. And we get all hung up on the fact that they sold everything and they lived in communes. We say, we ain't going there. It's not the American way. But that was just the strategy that they used. That wasn't the issue. That was just something that they did so that they could give to anyone as he had need. That's why they had favor with all the people. And notice it wasn't they gave to each other in the church as they had need. No, they gave to anyone as he or she had need. They sacrificed for the sake of others, and they were generous toward those in need, and they therefore had the favor of all the people. 1 Peter, live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, suppose they might do that once in a while. Yeah. In spite of the fact that they accuse you of doing wrong, they see your good deeds and, as a result of it, glorify God on the day that he visits us. I got news for you, folks. The only people that are going to be glorifying God on the day that he visits us are going to be those of us who are ready for his coming. I want to talk to you just for a moment about the wedding of outreach and evangelism in practice. In the Sacramento area, there's a church, you maybe have heard of it, Bayside of Granite Bay. Grayside of Bay is now about 15, 16, 17 years old. When it was 10 years old, on the main campus at Granite Bay, at that time they had about 10,000 showing up. I think they had planted at that time about three, maybe four other other Baysides around the Sacramento area. Their ultimate vision and goal is to have a Bayside church or a Bayside opportunity to worship in every major community in the Sacramento area. That's their goal eventually. And at that time, when they were 10 years old, I think they had three or maybe four of those in operation. And since it was their 10th anniversary, they decided that it would be a really good thing if that year, in celebration of the church's history, they thought it would be a really good idea if they got all the Bayside people together and worshiped. And so on Easter Sunday of that year, they rented out the Arco Arena. And the people who study that kind of thing say that they believe it was the largest single gathering of Christian people in the history of Northern California. One church, 10 years old. And how did that happen? Well, that church has been built on a mantra that says, good works produces goodwill, giving opportunity for the good news. See, the good news here is you're doing a lot of good works. What needs to happen is we need to start doing them in ways that result in people hearing the good news and coming to faith in Christ. So you have numerous outreach activities, but you're not reaping a robust spiritual harvest from these outreach efforts. Your work is incomplete. Your mission is to evangelize and disciple people. I'd quibble a little bit about the Santa Clara because I don't think you want to say, if somebody outside of the Santa Clara Valley wants to come to Jesus, I don't think you're going to get in their way, you know. But it's okay to say it because it starts at home. So it's okay to say it, to evangelize and disciple the people of Santa Clara and Santa Clara Valley. But we want to say the problem you have is a lack of vision. And so our first prescription is this. We prescribe that you would adopt the following goal-based vision for 2013. See, no matter how high and lofty the words are, and I've seen some vision statements that are incredibly inspiring, but until they are translated into actual measurable goals so that you know when you've accomplished it or you know the degree to which you've accomplished it, until you've done that, a vision really doesn't change anybody's behavior. And so we're suggesting and prescribing for you that you would adopt the following goal-based vision for the year 2013. Our suggestion is that you'd adopt it for 2013. Maybe keep the same framework for maybe a couple of years after it. Change the numbers as you feel God lead you in the coming years. But go with it for about 3 years. And then at the end of the 3 years, you can ask yourselves the question, is this in fact working for us, or do we need to express our vision in a different way? But we're bringing this to you simply because this is a vision which there are many churches now across the United States who have adopted either this or something very, very close to it. And then by working toward this vision, are seeing God work in ways that they had not seen for years, and in some instances they had never seen God work before in their church. So this is not some stuff pulled out of the hat. This is some stuff that God is using and blessing in other situations. The first goal would be that you would baptize a minimum of 15 new adult converts. Your second would be that you would have a minimum of 90 people involved in life groups. You have about 70 now. 90, minimum. If you get 120, we won't come around and slap you up alongside the head. You know, you get 120, we'll just praise God with you. But a minimum of, work toward that. Third, a minimum of 65% of the people involved in some form of ministry or mission. Ministry we typically use to describe the things that you do on campus that are primarily for the people who are part of the church or who will come to the church. Mission is typically those things that you do off campus, primarily for the people who don't come to the church, can't come to the church, or won't come to the church. You're already at 55%. This is increasing it to two-thirds, which is kind of the floor for health. Third, or next, would be to increase giving to a minimum of 6% of the congregational household income. Now, what are we talking about here? Well, let's see where you're at currently. The median household income for your area is $110,468. Incidentally, I'm going to stop here. Every time I use this graphic in a church, whatever the numbers are, the church goes, "That ain't us. I don't make that kind of money." I've had some that have really been so convinced, I've just said, "Well, do your own homework on it and get back to me on what, you know, tell me what the right numbers are." I have yet for a church to come back with significantly different numbers. You have 110 households. Some of these are single people, single income. Some of them are families. Some of them are single families with single income. Some are families with multiple incomes, double incomes, dual incomes. But you have 110 households. Now, hang on to your hats here. What that means then is, if your church is average to your community, your income as a congregation in 2011 was a little bit over $12 million. And if you were, as a church, on the average, a tithing people, the congregational income for the church would have been $1.2 million. It was $609,000. It means you are currently giving half a tithe, 5%. Now, the good news is the average for a church in America today is 2.8%. So you can give yourself a hand for being above average. But are you happy with the above average? That's the question. So your average household per giving is $5,538. Well, what we're suggesting is that part of your vision-based goal, goal-based vision, would be 6% minimum by the end of next year. So you're all growing and you're giving. The final piece would be a minimum of 45 people in the church having been instrumental in helping someone come to faith. Now, we're suggesting that your goal should be 15, a minimum of 15, to adult converts to baptize in the coming year. The reality is this, that when somebody comes to faith, it's almost always a number of different people who've influenced them. Very few of us. How many of you came to faith because of only one person? It was just one person who introduced you to Christ. Everything that you knew about the faith when you made the decision came from the one person. Any of you? Yeah. And that's the way it is. You know, I ask this question many times, and there's usually two or three people who, yeah, that's what happened. You know, I was living this pagan life, and this Christian got a hold of me, and you know, I had no other influence. This person led me to Christ. But that's not most of our stories. Most of our stories, that list is 3, 4, 5, 8, 10 people long. Well, how do you live this out? If I come back and work with you as your coach, I'll help you flesh this out more, but let me give it to you in a nutshell, because this is not rocket science. It's not costly, and it's not threatening. You don't have to have a seminary degree to be able to do this. A simple strategy for having not you all sitting in the pews waiting for pastor to preach the evangelistic sermon that brings 22 people up here to the front, but where all of you are part of a culture in this church that says we are building relationships to help people come to Jesus. Simple strategy. You identify three unchurched, unbelieving people or families that are in your life. They're part of your oikos. They're part of your family, friends, neighbors, or coworkers. And you begin you make a commitment to begin developing a relationship with them. So it means you begin to actually plan and schedule time to be with them. You begin to invite them to your home. You begin to do things together with them that they want to do, what they want to do. And you begin to build a relationship. So there will come a time when it would be just natural to talk to them about spiritual things. Or there will come a time where something's going on at church and you could say, hey, would you come? Would you like to come? Let me tell you how this works. You got all these incredible things that you're doing for the community. You got the stuff you could do. You're going down and after the hurricanes and that kind of thing. You know how effective evangelism is happening in a lot of churches? The people from the guys and gals from the church that go do that, they don't just pack up and get on and do that. They don't just talk to three other people at the church and convince them to go along. They go to their unsaved neighbors and friends and say, hey, you know what? There's a bunch of us going down to Louisiana, and we're going to do some stuff to clean up after Isaac. Would you be interested in coming with us? Oh, yeah, man, I'd love to do that. Well, come on, here's how we're leaving at such and such a time, let's go. That's how it happens. That's how it happens. Because once you bring them into contact with the church, now you have all of the resources of the church that God can bring to bear in helping them come to faith. You don't have to know 95 scripture verses off the top of your head. You don't have to know. I mean, it's helpful if you know the Roman road. It's helpful if you know how to use in an appropriate way peace to God or those kinds of things. But you don't have to have all of that down. Because what you're doing is you're becoming the bridge over which they walk into the life of the church. And when they come into the life of the church, God brings to bear all of the resources of the church to help bring them to faith. But it starts with you identifying these people, praying for them, and beginning to build the relationship with them so that you, in fact, can become the bridge over which they walk into the life of the church and into a relationship with Jesus. You know what? It is as simple as that. 2 weeks ago, I had the privilege of taking about 21 GHC pastors to Dallas, Texas, and we bought a day of a pastor's time down there. His name is Steve Stroop, and we put our guys in a room with Steve for a day and just let them pick his brain. And we picked Steve because Steve is a very effective pastor. He started his church 31 years ago in a bait shop, and today there's 12,000 people on the average on the weekend on the main campus, and they have four other campuses around Dallas. He's figured out how to reach this culture. The interesting thing is, when he began to talk, he described this very program. They've been doing it for years. It is the key growth engine in their church. And I'm sitting there, and I'm kind of chuckling to myself. Because about 18 years ago, I spoke to a group of pastors under the auspices of Leadership Network in Atlanta, Georgia, and I talked about this, and Steve Stroop was in there. He heard it, made a couple of small adaptations, and here, 18 years later now, he goes back and says, that was one of the things that we did that all of a sudden made us begin to grow like we did. How much budget do you need for that? How much budget do you need? Not a big deal. Prescription number two, focus on outreach that, first of all, creates presence and builds relationships. You want to get your outreach efforts focused, and focus on those things that create presence and build relationships. And focus on outreach that results in unchurched, unbelieving people coming into the life of the church and a relationship with Jesus. So establish in relationship to this a goal that every local outreach in 2013 results in at least one household becoming involved in the life of the church, if not already in a relationship with Jesus. I would suggest that you take a look at your distance ones as well, and kind of set the goal that you, as best you can, do those in ways that go beyond a cup of cold water. Do those in ways that, and in conjunction with maybe churches where some of the people that you help actually can wind up in some relationships with Christian people and a connection to a church where ultimately you're not just helping them clean up after a mess and a tragedy, but you're actually becoming one of the stepping stones that God uses to help them come to faith in Him. In other words, you really want your outreach to reap eternal harvest and eternal benefit. Prescription number three, initiate a system for or strengthen your existing system for assimilation by April 1, 2013, leader development by June 1, 2013, and communication by September 1, 2013. Prescription number four, streamline and modernize leadership and your governance system. What we are proposing is that we will present to your board a model of governance that is working incredibly well, not just in GHC churches, but in churches all across the United States. And by April 1, they can take a look at it and decide whether they believe it will, in fact, work here. If it doesn't, we'll make it possible for you to look at some other models, but that by November 1, you would have either the accountability model or a similar modern, effective governance model in place and operative by November 1, 2013. Your approach to structure and your approach to leadership and governance in this church is straight out of the 1950s. And there are very few churches that use it today. There are no healthy growing churches that use it. And the reason that it's not being used is because it's not very effective. The truth of the matter is you guys have made it work better than I've seen in a long, long time. But it's still not a good system. And there are much better systems out there. Prescription number five, by or actually on October 7th, vote to accept or reject prescriptions 1 through 4 in their entirety. These prescriptions are not smorgasbord. See, my doctor, he says, hey, your blood pressure's up a little bit. We'll give you a small dose of this. Take care of your blood pressure. I do that. That's easy. I take a pill in the morning. No problem. The eat less and exercise more, which would probably take away my need to take the pill in the morning. Since it's smorgasbord and I get to choose, I do what's easy, I do what I want to do. It doesn't work if you have smorgasbord here and pick the ones you want. In some ways that's maybe obvious to you, in other ways maybe not so obvious. These are connected. And you need to do them all or don't do any of them. Now, the deal is that if you vote in the affirmative to accept these prescriptions and the church requests it, a coach will be gifted to the church by GHC to assist you in following through on the prescriptions. And probability would be me. If at all possible, it would be me. But the region cares enough about the churches to say, we will pay for staff time to come alongside churches and help them implement the prescriptions if they are serious about wanting to follow the prescriptions and implement them. And so you wouldn't be on your own to try and do this. Because our experience is, no matter how capable the leadership of the church is, they're not capable of doing it on their own. They need coaching along the way. And so that would be provided to you if you choose to do this. Now, there is one other prescription that we're not asking you to vote on on October 7. As a matter of fact, we're not asking you to vote on it because it actually would be something that if you agree to this prescription or if your board agrees that this is the best way to go, that's a board decision, not a congregational one anyway. So what we're suggesting is, and our prescription here, is that by January 1, 2012, you would enter into an intentional transition phase. I'm sorry, that should be 13. Yeah. You didn't catch me. I kept doing that last night. We were putting this thing together, and it kept saying 2013, 2013, and I have to go back. And he didn't, yeah. Yeah. Sorry, it's 2013. I'll correct it before I give you this PowerPoint, which you can be able to print off and everything. So by January 1 of 2013, thank you for catching me on that, you would enter into an intentional transition phase. What do we mean by that? It means that you would begin doing the things that are typically done and need to be done by a church as it readies itself for its next chapter and its next senior pastor. It's no secret among you that Pastor Rich is not a kid anymore. And he'd like to have a little bit of retirement at some point. And so the reality is it's time to prepare yourself for that. And so what we're suggesting is that the beginning of the year, you begin to enter into this. Now, what do we mean by this? What are the things that are typically done? Well, what are typically done, first of all, is an assessment. Well, that's pretty easy. Got that one licked already. We don't have to come back January and do another one. This one's good. But typically this transition, this intentional transition process that increasingly churches are using today with great results, starts with an assessment. And then it identifies the things that need to be taken care of, the prescriptions. And so the completion of the prescriptions is part of what happens in this transition period. And then clarifying of the mission and vision, if that's needed, and, oh yeah, it is needed here, so, you know, that would be part of it. And in a sense, we're taking care of that because one of the prescriptions is addressing that. So as we begin actually in this period of time working toward the accomplishing of that vision, we're actually a step ahead of the process, and that's a good thing. And then at the appropriate time, as you get to the place, and again, we can coach you as to when that time comes, at that point, you establish and train a search team, and then you move into the search process, and you complete the search process. And that's what a transition phase is about, and what we're saying at this point is you do it intentionally and decide to move into that starting in January. Now, in terms of intentional transition phases, typically how they work is, first of all, they last about 12 to 30 months. So anything from 12 to 30 months is normal. Usually it's 18, 24, somewhere in that range. But sometimes it can be done in 12. Sometimes it can take up to 30 months. So that's the range. But typically it involves the pastors resigning first, and then the calling of an intentional interim pastor, one who comes in and guides you through the process that I just described on the screen before. And increasingly, though, today, the intentional transition pastor role is being filled by the current retiring pastor. He already knows you. You already know him. He's going to continue to be your pastor. But what's different is there's a very clearly defined set of objectives that are to be accomplished in this transition time, the prescriptions, working toward the mission and vision in a focused way. And there is the coaching to help him lead in that way. And all of this then makes a seamless transition for the church. And you don't go through this terrible chasm of time where you have somebody coming in from the outside, pushing and shoving and arguing with you to get everything done that needs to be done, and then going out and trying to find someone. It also allows your pastor to finish well. It allows him to be coached to do some of the things he might not do if he just was your pastor until he decides to retire. It gives him the satisfaction of knowing that when he walks away, you are prepared and you are ready for your next pastor. Most of the disasters that happen from one pastor to the next is because the church really isn't prepared for that next pastor. And the next pastor comes in and has all kinds of problems, and the church has all kinds of struggles with the pastor because they weren't prepared. And so increasingly, when a pastor is retiring, we are moving to this kind of a model, and it works exceedingly well. And the assessment team believes that with coaching, Pastor Rich is more than capable of serving in this role for you. So our prescription is this, that by November 15th, the board and Pastor Rich determine if Pastor Rich will serve as the intentional transition pastor. And if the agreement is yes, we will help write the contract and the agreement, the understanding of what the transition part of it is. He'll continue to be your pastor just as he has for all of these years in every other respect, but we will define very clearly what the expectations are for the transition. You'll enter into that transition period of time, and when it's done and when it's the right time, you will have identified your next pastor, and you will have the delight of 1 week thanking and honoring your pastor for years of faithful service to you, and the next week welcoming your next pastor that you are ready for. Now, if either Pastor Rich looks and says, "Wow, this is going to be a lot of work, and I don't think I got the energy for it," or, you know, I think even with coaching, I'm not sure I can do it. You know, if he goes, "I don't think so," you know, we'll go to the normal model. We can do that. Whenever the time is appropriate, we'll go to the normal model. But, or if the board, in discussing it, you know, says, "We don't think this is the best way," well, we'll work with you to say, okay, how does this play out then? But it's our conviction as the assessment team that this can work, and it would be a win for the pastor, be a win for the church, and it'd be a win for your next pastor as well. So, anybody want me to start at the beginning again? All right, it's Q&A time, finally.
I like the idea of the coaching, and I know you would work very closely with Pastor Rich. Would you also be working with the other lay leaders in their...
Great question. Yeah, great question. The congregational coaching relationship, which we typically use in GHC, if I or another coach that I've trained comes in, what we typically do is we spend the morning working with the pastor, so it's kind of one-on-one. We will have sometimes coaching conversations at a distance between. But every time we're on campus, and typically that's it's at least every other month that we're on campus, and depending upon what we're working on, we might go through a phase where it's actually every month we're on campus for 2, 3, 4 months. But it's at least every other month. And so in the morning, it's coaching the pastor. The afternoon is coaching the pastor and the staff. And in the evening, we're coaching lay leaders, sometimes the board, sometimes lay ministry leaders. And so in the course of a coaching day, we actually are spending time with all facets and all aspects of the leadership of the church. Yes, it is. Oftentimes, depends on what we're working on. Usually if we're working on the governance piece, that's something we work with the board on. For example, if we start talking about the systems and all, we would bring together the lay leaders who would be that we're going to look to for leadership in terms of the systems, and I'd be working with them together. So it does. Who we work with in the evening varies from month to month, but over time we get significant amount of time with pretty much all of the key lay leaders in the church. Great question. One over here.
Yeah, you mentioned something about the cultural profile of this area, and you said that it's similar to the suburbs
DC?
Of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah, basically, in this area, you have a lot of professionals, young couples, professionals, very busy.
Yep.
And they tend to be very individualistic.
Yep.
Do you have, by any chance, you know, any success story from another similar church that found a good way to reach, to approach them and, to,
sure.
and something like this?
Well, actually, you have some here. You don't have to go to D.C. to find them. But I can introduce you to some in D.C. As well. One of the churches I had the privilege of working with, they were already large by the time I went to work with them. They were about 6,000 on a weekend. And they're now about 12, but it varies on the weekend, but they'll be between 12 and 14,000 on a weekend. I mean, they have definitely figured out how to crack the code. And the interesting thing is how you crack, one of the keys to cracking the code is that usually what happens is you say, oh, these are busy people, and you know, and if we ask too much of them, they'll flee and all of this kind of thing. One of the things I see that is almost without exception a key piece of the churches that are cracking the code of cultures like yours, they are high expectation churches, not low expectation churches. If you're going to be part of this church, we expect this, 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 and this of you, but people will buy in because we're about doing this. The mission and vision is clear, and they look at that and say, I want to be part of that. But the expectation is high. They come in. They're committed to it. I'm doing a capital campaign at church in Annapolis right now. I cannot believe the caliber of people who immediately, when we asked them to play a role in the capital campaign, immediately said, absolutely, I'll do it. And these are the kind of people that most of the time we'd look at and say, oh man, he's on the road all the time. She's so busy. There's no way they're going to do it. No, because it's a high expectation context for the church. So there are examples out there. Yeah, and some of them are local. You got some that are cracking the code here, and you need to not criticize them, but go find out what they're doing. And some of what they're doing, it ain't you. But some of what they're doing, work here too. Great question. Okay.
Question about the prescription for the accountability model.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming we don't have time to go into that in detail now.
Yeah, it takes a while to explain it.
Yes, but will we find out about
that? Let me give you the quick overview. The quick overview would be this. It is a model that makes it really clear that the pastor has the responsibility and the authority to lead. The staff manages the ministries of the church, and the board governs. And the board governs not through the giving and withholding of permission for specific ministry things that the pastor wants to do, but by putting into place policies that in advance say, first of all, you cannot do these things. There's one section of the documentation for this approach that every single policy in it starts out, the senior pastor shall not. And what it is it's painting the out of bounds. Pastor cannot do these things. But anything that is not forbidden is potentially permissible. It is permissible. And so the pastor has the freedom to make choices about ministry and how ministry will be done. I mean, after all, they're the one in the church with the most training, you know, and hopefully enough experience. If they aren't, you probably made a wrong choice. I sometimes use the illustration. It was about six and a half years ago now. I went in for my annual physical. Doctor called me back a few days and said, there's some numbers here I don't like. We want you to take another test. So I go in and take the test. A couple of days later, I get the phone call everybody dreads. You know, you got cancer. Well, being the kind of person I am, I'm going to figure out, first of all, what's the treatment, you know, and I came to the conclusion that surgery was the best thing for me. And so then I don't want to be the first guy that, you know, that surgeon operates on. So I start doing my homework, and I got some friends that go out, and everybody in the medical community that they knew saying, you know, if you or your loved one needed this surgery, who would you go to? And when the name of these two doctors who did the surgery together kept coming up, go meet them, find out on the wall. They've been nationally recognized for, you know, what they do. Go in, talk to them, like them and everything. I made them hold out their hands to see how steady they were. And, you know, I mean, it was just, you know. And I come away with the conclusion, okay, these are the guys I'm going to trust myself to. And now, having done that, imagine if on the day of surgery, I go, oh, wait a minute, don't put me out. I want you to give me a local because I want to tell you how to do the surgery. But that's what churches do. That's what churches do. You know, we tell the professional how to do it. Now, it's not a blank check to the pastor, because the accountability part is, first of all, they can't violate the boundary principles. And the second thing is, there are very specific ministry goals that are agreed upon by the pastor and the board every year. And the pastor has the primary responsibility, with the board supporting him, staff supporting him, but the pastor has the primary responsibility of accomplishing those mission goals. And if he doesn't, he is accountable to the board for that. So there's accountability all over the place. But it moves away from boards that give permission. I mean, I work with pastors. They have to ask permission every year to do the same thing. You know, want to do it again this year, they have to ask the board. I mean, it's craziness. And so, at any rate, that's in a big picture what it is. So the pastor leads, staff manages, and that staff means not only paid but volunteer staff, and the board governs by policies that are established in advance. The final thing I would say about it is one of the great advantages of this is that if you don't have to sit there month by month and listen to reports and decide whether or not the pastor and the staff can do this, that, and the next thing, what are you going to do with your time? Well, what you do with your time is you look at the big picture. You look at the overall health of the church. You see what changes are happening in the neighborhood, and you begin to think down the road so that the church is prepared when something begins to develop. You've already thought about it. Your leaders have already thought about it. They've already prayed about it. You already know what you're going to do and how you're going to respond to it when it comes. And it's a whole new day. It's a whole new day for a church. So, great. Other questions?
You said something about outreach being focused towards presence and relationship, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And we have a Mexico trip every year, and people come back from that and report in ways that sound very much to me like that's exactly what's going on.
Sure,
there.
Sure.
Now, am I misinterpreting that, or are you thinking of doing something like that locally?
That's the point. See, if in fact that's what's happening in Mexico, and they recognize you and you come back, but now if that's the only contact they have with Christians, there's still something wrong there. You want to maybe partner up with a church, so that some of the people from a local church are working with you on that project, so that they're not only connecting with you, but they're connecting with somebody who's there for 365. So there might be some adjustments. I don't know exactly the details of how you're doing it. But yeah, you're going back to the same community. You're not going to different communities every time, if I understand it. So you're going back to the same community. You're making an impact there. You have a presence there. They know you. They respect you. I'm talking about doing the same thing here. So, for example, one church I'm working with in the L.A. area, they have an apartment complex near them. And it's a low-income complex. And they have begun to do a whole assortment of things, starting with when the school year begins, they go in and every kid in the apartment complex gets new clothes, school clothes, not just one outfit, but gets school clothes, and all the supplies that they need for the year. During the summer, they have somebody goes in and teaches the kids to swim. Because many of these are inept parents or parents who are struggling. They're good parents, but they're struggling because they're single parents maybe. So every month they put on some training and teaching in parenting for the parents. There's just a whole variety of things that they do, but they keep going back to this apartment building, and they're building relationships. And now what's happening is families, not just the kids, traipsing over to the church to give mom and dad a little quiet on Sunday morning. The whole family is coming over to the church on Sunday morning, and they're getting involved in the life of the church. So they've created a presence there. They're burrowing down there. The people know that this isn't hit and run. These people really care about us, and it's beginning to have an eternal impact on the lives of people. So it's that kind of drilling down kind of thing. So it's taking a look at the school and not just, you know, doing an occasional thing for it, but how can we actually begin to build ongoing relationships with the staff? How can we begin to connect with some of the families? And you've got some examples. First Baptist Stockton, one of your sister churches, They figured out how to crack the code with one of the schools in the area, and they have their own school. I mean, in a sense, the church is in competition with the school, but in spite of the fact they have their own school, they've managed it, and they figured out how to actually get to the parents of this school, not just the children. So there's ways to do it.
just add a point to all that Bill has told you. In our 21st century world in the United States, if you want to be successful in finding the right leader and the most outstanding leader for this church after you finish all of this, you're going to have to enter into this in order to do that. Because you're not going to find the capable leader out there in the world that we have in our country unless you are fully prepared with the mission and vision that you have bought into by doing, starting on the road with your goal to be successful and successfully completing the intentional transition phase. If you do that, the chances of the next pastor being the leader that you want go up dramatically and are almost assured.
Yeah. See, the problem is you have a lot of unfinished business, and you have some hurts and some stuff and issues that need to be addressed. If you don't address them, the kind of pastor that can help you address those things are typically not the kind of pastor that you need to lead you actually in the next phase. And so that's part of why it works so well to have the retiring pastor guide you through that so that, you know, you are ready for that next pastor, and when that next pastor comes, they can hit the ground running because there's not any of this old stuff that needs to be dealt with. You're ready to go from, yeah, we're committed to this vision, we're going, help us figure out how to do this, let's go, and you've already identified a person who has a passion for that vision and wants to help you get there. Doesn't come to you with a vision of their own that's different, kind of a thing. So, yeah. Another question.
Board or the church, I don't know who makes this decision, but if the decision is made to ask you to coach us through this, mm-hmm. what is the very first thing you do after you hear of that decision?
Pray. Well, the very first thing I would do is I'd be on the phone with pastor scheduling things because my schedule gets very full and I have to schedule well in advance. And so that literally would be the first thing that I would do. But we would come in and, one of the very first things I would begin to work with, you have the building blocks, as I said earlier. And so one of the first things I'd be trying to do is to help you make the adjustments and figure out how to make some of the adjustments in some of your outreach things so that they could potentially begin to produce evangelistic results. I'd begin to work, obviously, toward, well, if you're going to set a goal of 15 conversions, you know, you've barely achieved that twice in the last 10 years. So what do we need to do to make it so that that actually becomes a strong possibility, if not, in fact, something that we achieve? So beginning to coach you in terms of what are some of the things that we see working in other places. We'll talk about whether or not they can work here and begin to go after those kinds of things. And then we'd begin to take a look at certainly be meeting with the board and talking about the accountability model so they can have time to think and pray over it, decide whether that's the direction to go in. So it's that kind of thing. The agenda is really clear because it's the prescriptions. Now, practically speaking, other things always come up. Usually the coaching relationship is about a year long, and every time I've done a congregational coaching job, I always there's other things that come up during the course of the year, and so we'll talk about those, we'll deal with those, but the focus is getting the prescriptions accomplished. Oh, yeah.
Do you
I kind of had a question when you talk about modernizing our board. Do you have a prescription? And I'm sure they're doing prayerfully and the best that they can. So what do you mean by modernizing the board?
The fact that you have an antiquated system is not a judgment on any person functioning in leadership in this church right now. The fact is you have very committed and many very capable leaders. It's not a judgment on them at all. It's the approach that you use to making decisions and providing leadership to this church today is a very antiquated and for a church your size, cumbersome system. There are significantly better ways to do it, and it has nothing to do with people and their performance. It has to do with the system. Yeah.
You said mission must trump relationships.
Give her the mic.
You said missions trumps relationships. What do you? Give us some examples. What do you mean by that?
Sure. Well, an example, I actually gave you one. It just wasn't recognizable as that. But an example of that would be, I'll pick on men's ministry. And I'm going to use men's ministry because I know it's not the situation in your church, but you got somebody in your church, they've never led anything. But we need somebody to lead men's ministry, so they go okay, and they get in a position and they don't know how to lead. It's not very effective, but it's really important to them that they lead men's ministry because you know they're important if they are leading men's ministry. And men's ministry has, you know, six guys and then four guys, you know, who show up for a breakfast once a month or something. And that's the extent of men's ministry. And you realize that if this church is really going to flourish and this church is going to accomplish what God wants us to do, we need to be doing something more effective than that. And for the men who are here, and in addition to that, we need to start reaching men who are out there. In an institutional church, you go, oh, man, it's really important. He leads men's ministry. And he's going to feel bad if we, you know, take it away from him. So we let men's ministry languish until who knows. That, in that instance, relationship has trumped mission. See, every ministry of the church needs the best leadership that you have so that it can, in fact, accomplish the mission and the vision. It has to help you make disciples. And if it doesn't, then you need to resource the person, help them grow into it. If they can't grow into it, you need to, you know, could you step aside and take care of this part while this person takes the leadership of the whole? Or, you know, I'll give you an example. We had a guy in one of my churches. He was absolutely convinced that he had the gift of teaching. And I had him substitute a couple times for adult classes, and every time he would teach an adult class, I would have people in my office the next week saying, "Don't you ever do that to us again." But he was convinced he had the gift of teaching. Kept begging for a class. There was no way we were going to give him a class. But finally, you know, I got to make the point, got to get through to him somehow. In the summers, we had electives. And so one summer, we gave him an elective class to teach. And he got publicized like every other teacher, every other class. And I made sure that on the first Sunday of the electives that summer, I had nothing to do during the Sunday school hour. Because I knew I had a job to do. And so about 7-8 minutes after the classes had been assembled, nobody's in the hallways anymore, I walked into the room where Woody was and found exactly what I expected to find. Woody sitting there alone with the most puzzled look on his face. And I, you know, as his pastor, I had to say, "Woody, you know, you believe you've got the gift of teaching, but biblically, the Bible teaches that gifts are affirmed by the body. Nobody's here. Every time you've taught, I've had people tell me you don't teach well. You may think it's your gift, but it's not your gift. That was a hard conversation to have. But my job at that point, I had to have that conversation with him, but I also had the responsibility to say, Woody, I got to help you figure out how God has wired you to serve him. And Woody was a little different, so it took a little while. But we did find a place ultimately. See, it's that kind of thing that you have to do because the mission has to be the thing. And anything and anybody who contributes to the mission, you feed them. And anybody who doesn't, you move them to an area where they can contribute to the mission and vision. Well, it's 3 o'clock. We've been at this for a while. Both Terry and I will be here for a little bit. I have an airplane to catch, so I won't be here for real long. But I will be here for a few minutes, and if you want to come on up and talk to either one of us, you may do that. But I'd like to have the privilege of praying for you, if I may.
If you want to be a part of it to talk about what your thoughts are and helping you process, it will be here at the church on Tuesday night at 7 in the evening. It'll be again in the parlor. And we have another meeting, I think, for some others set up for later in the week. But I just want to announce that right now, 7 o'clock Tuesday night, if you'd like to come and talk more about what Dr. Hoyt has shared with us. Thank you, sir.
Cool. Lord. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's pray. Lord, these are wonderful people. They're your people. You know them. You know them better than we do. You know their hearts. You know what they want. And even though maybe some of the adjustments and changes will be difficult for some folk, in the end, what we want is your blessing. We want you to look and say, well done, good and faithful service. We want you to be pleased because this church is accomplishing what you have put this church in this community and in this world to do. And so I pray, Father, that in the discussions and in the praying that they do and then in the vote that they take, that your spirit would be guiding them at every juncture. And I pray that the focus, the understandings, the decisions that are made, and then the behaviors that follow that will all contribute to this church becoming fully engaged in making disciples. And we will give you the praise, the honor, and the glory when that happens because we know that it will be as a result of your Spirit's blessing, and we would not presume to take credit for that which you do. In your name we pray. Amen.